Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, do you know what a ransomware-style attack is? We're going to talk about that and a whole bunch more with Beth Wendt. She's a senior IT specialist of UW's Madison's Division of Information Technology. She brings 20 years of experience and a love for creative problem solving to the show, so it's great to have her back. Talking about cybersecurity with her, what kinds of attacks companies, the government, even universities are at risk of, and we'll learn about the recent ransomware attack with Garmin that affected my watch. Maybe it affected yours. We'll also talk about what you need to know in order to protect yourself and how to online shop safely. So we can also answer other tech questions as well. I'm sure she can, and I hope you'll join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. And Beth Wendt, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. How are you? Thanks for having me back on the show.
Yeah, it's great. I'm feeling pretty darn good today. My watch wasn't feeling so good, though, the end of July. There was a ransom. Yeah. Well, before we even get to that, ransomware versus cyber attack, are they the same thing? What's the difference if they're not?
Well, so a ransomware is a specific type of cyber attack. So it's just one of the ways that some bad actor would attempt to compromise the security of a computer system in order to gain, you know, financially from that act. So ransomware is really one of many, many different ways that those folks go about intrusion and disruption in order to, you know, either gain information or money.
So they're after, that's the motivation for a group to hack things like this, money primarily?
Generally with ransomware, it's money related. So the way a ransomware attack often goes down is an evil actor or a bad actor, as we call them, or will take over a computer system in a way that encrypts the data on that computer system so that the owner of that system is no longer able to get to that data. And often that happens to businesses that have really important proprietary data or systems that manage their end user products, like the Garmin attack, where there was an outage because of it. So they take over the system and encrypt it so that the actual IT folks who run that system can't get into it to do anything, take the system offline, and then they basically, like they would in a kidnapping of a person, they hold that system ransom until you pay, and you won't be able to decrypt that system until you pay them whatever they demand.
Wow. And are there big name groups who are known to do these types of things repeatedly?
You know, it's funny. I was reading an article about this, and there's actually a group that calls themselves Evil Corp, which it sounds to me like it's something out of a comic book. Or a Marvel movie, but they call themselves Evil Corp, and supposedly based out of Russia, and they haven't necessarily claimed this particular attack, but a lot of the experts in the cybersecurity world are pointing their fingers at this Russian group of hackers.
And from what I understand about this Garmin incident, hackers, they basically lock Garmin out of their own data, as you were talking about or describing. But they didn't steal any of their data, and that seems odd to me. Why would they do that?
Well, and you don't know if they stole data or not. That's the
okay.
thing. Anytime your system is compromised in that way, it becomes very difficult to tell if any of that data actually left the system, because the hacker then has really complete control to cover their tracks. They're basically within your computer system and able to make it very difficult to find out what they did while they were there. So there's no guarantee that no data actually left, and companies are generally pretty reticent to announce that unless there are regulatory requirements for them to tell people that their data was lost.
Boy, I tell you, is this a matter of big companies having a lot of holes in their security, or are these hackers just really good at what they do?
You know, unfortunately, the security folks are always going to be one step behind. It's really difficult to do security proactively. Honestly, a lot of security lessons are learned the hard way. There are strategies that larger organizations put in place to create layers of security that tend to make things more fortified and less likely to be compromised. But really what it all boils down to is every end user of any computer-related product needs to be diligent and protect their own data. Make sure that they are vetting the sources that they are giving their information to, and that they're doing the things necessary to secure their own systems.
It just seems to me sometimes that if they're so smart about this, they could make an awful lot of money just doing things legitimately.
One would think, right? You put so much effort into something illegal. If you put that much effort into a legal strategy for making money, you probably do pretty well. I know a lot of folks who used to be hackers in the, you know, more nefarious way, who, you know, came to terms with what they were doing and turned what we call a white hat, or, you know, more the good guy hackers who do like penetration testing and try to help, you know, bring light or bring attention to vulnerabilities in systems for organizations so that they can help them secure those from future compromises.
Yeah. How frequently do these hacks or ones like this happen? The companies don't necessarily have to tell the public, I suppose, but
there are definitely like certain types of data loss that companies are required to report to the public. So if there's financial data loss or healthcare data loss, or personally identifying information that was compromised, those are all instances where there are federal regulations that require organizations who have compromises like that to disclose that to their users or to the public. But not always. And also companies don't always follow those rules, so you might not know. So again, I'll just reiterate, it's really important that people protect themselves and don't expect the organizations that you're doing business with to protect you necessarily.
So as an individual, you need to be worried about this.
Diligent. And I would say diligent.
All right. And so how do we be diligent?
So there's a number of things you can do to really protect yourself from having accounts compromised. But the one that I always like to emphasize the most is not reusing passwords. That is the most important thing that any end user can do to protect their own data, is to not reuse passwords. Because if your password is compromised in one attack and you reuse that in many other locations, they may be able to get to more than just your Garmin data, if Garmin is the one who is attacked. So that's really like the top priority, is not reusing passwords.
Beth Wendt, our guest today, she is an IT person with the Division of Information Technology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, or DOIT as we call it. She's been doing this for about 20 years now, so she knows a lot. Questions for her either about security, or maybe you've got another tech question, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So many more people have been online shopping. I think especially during this pandemic, many people who wouldn't usually do it. So what kind of risks are we taking by purchasing online?
Well, again, you know, similar to how you would want to protect your data on your computer at home, you want to protect your data that you're transmitting to other organizations that you're doing business with. So there are a number of ways that you can really be diligent about that. One of them is to make sure you're shopping with trusted vendors, a vendor who you know, who you're familiar with, who you've done some vetting of. I know there are a lot of great review sites out there where you can read reviews of vendors, and it's a very good way to find out if people have been scammed or had data compromises with that organization or company. Making sure that your computer at home is hardened, so updating the operating system on your machine, making sure you've got a security software package on there, like a virus scanner and a malware scanning software. Usually those come with a firewall as well, so those are extra layers of protection. And then backing up your data regularly is, I cannot emphasize that enough. Get a cloud provider like Google Drive or OneDrive or one of the cloud providers, and all of your critical data, back it up to the cloud, you know, once a day, once a week. Then you're not going to fall victim to one of these ransomware attacks.
Yeah, and that can that be done automatically, right? Or
yeah, absolutely. And there are companies that are specifically for backing up your data, and you pay like a yearly subscription fee, and it's very automated, and you can set it up to happen in the middle of the night when you're not using the machine, so you don't notice any like slowness or anything when it's happening. And it can just happen in the background, and it's something you just want to check up on periodically to make sure it's still doing what you expect it to do.
Yeah, for sure. Let's take a call. Nick in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Nick.
I have to admit some stuff here, but when I was in my 20s, I met this guy that went to school with. We were in our 20s, so I didn't have kids or nothing. And he got caught hacking, and he tried to poison the Chicago water system and stuff, and I had the FBI at my house and stuff. It was pretty scary, but like I said, he's sitting in the Supermax in Colorado now for hacking. I mean, there used to be shareware and try before you buy, and he'd write the scripts to register them for free and send the author the codes to register it, and just to be a jerk and stuff. But I'm glad I quit hanging off him now, because I got kids and I got a family and I can't be involved in that stuff. But like she said, passwords, we used to hack passwords all the time, so it was crazy.
Well, thanks, Nick, for calling. I appreciate it. How do they hack, Beth? Or maybe we shouldn't even talk about how to hack passwords on the air. But how does it work, kind of in general?
Well, there are password hacking tools that you can download online, and not even something you would need to go to like a dark website for. Just out on the regular internet, you can download a password cracking tool. And it really depends on the complexity of the password the person has chosen. If they're not very diligent and they're using actually recognizable words and only letters, it's going to be very easy to crack that password. That's going to take a matter of seconds for a password cracking tool. But if you're using not necessarily actual words, you're substituting characters with special characters instead of letters and numbers. Phrases work pretty well, but it's really using what we call a strong password. So, 15, 16 characters, alphanumeric, as well as capital and lowercase letters, and then also using special characters in there. And I know those can be hard to remember, but it's really important to use strong passwords in that case.
Well, we can take some more calls here. Joy in West Bend, we'll turn to you. What's on your mind, Joy?
Hi. One of my concerns is the security of voting machines. I have heard that voting machines can be hacked into, the numbers changed, and then whoever's doing this can come out and it might never be detected. So I'm wondering if there's any way that the leader of a precinct, voting precinct or whatever, can in real time monitor their machinery to find out if someone is hacking. It just seems like, you know, a little change in the count here and a little change in the count there can really affect an election. So that's my question.
You're not the only one, probably, Joy, thinking about that. Beth, what do you think?
I think there is a lot of concern surrounding voting machines and the security of them. A big part of the concern that I have is most of them are manufactured by a single company. I'm not quite certain of the political persuasion of that organization, but there are, there have been anecdotal evidence of vote switching happening in real time on voting machines, where people are going to, you know, select a certain candidate and the other candidate is selected for them. Basically, they're miscalibrating the touch screen, so it's offsetting where the actual touch is landing on those touchscreen voting machines. So it's actually like swinging votes to the other candidate where it shouldn't. And then, you know, election boards are county by county, and there are no federally mandated standards for security for those election boards. So they're all over the map. And honestly, really the only way in my mind to ensure a fair election is with paper ballot counting. I don't think the security around voting machines has gotten to where I feel very confident in it, honestly.
Oh, well, that's not a very bright
outlook. I know. I hate to be Debbie Downer on that one, but from what I've read, they're very easy to hack into.
Hmm. Betty in Dodgeville, it's your turn. We'll give you a chance. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I was just calling to – my health insurance wants me to sign up for my chart. And I understand that's over Epic. And my concern is, how secure is Epic, and is there a chance of them being hacked and my health insurance, my health info being out in the world?
Hmm. What do you think, Beth?
Yeah, I'd say that there's always a chance. But with Epic, Epic is one of the first organizations to start manufacturing medical records software. They're one of the earliest companies in the business. So they've certainly been doing this longer than most. I know that they have a formidable security group within Epic, and they're also regulated by something called HIPAA, which is health information security federal regulations that also require audits on their systems frequently. So there are folks from the federal government who come in and audit their systems to ensure that they have proper security measures in place to safeguard health insurance and health record data. I would say health record data is some of the most fiercely protected data in existence. So it's one area, as far as Epic goes, I'm not terribly concerned with losing data through them.
There you go, Betty. Thank you so much. Steve emailed wondering how secure cloud storage is. You talked about backup into cloud. How secure is that?
I think cloud storage has come a long way. It's certainly not a place that I would feel comfortable with storing protected information. So I wouldn't put social security numbers, bank records, any health information or anything that you don't want lost. I wouldn't put in a cloud vendor's product until I've done my research on that cloud vendor, because it really varies from product to product. You can have something like a Google Drive or a Box, which are both pretty high security and very well managed systems that I would trust with more protected information. And then you have some of the folks who are newer to the game who may not be protecting things as closely. So it's, again, kind of vetting the sources and the vendors that you're using.
Talking today with Beth Wendt, Senior IT Specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. We've focused in on ransomware attacks, cybersecurity, those kinds of things. But we can take your other IT questions as well. What's going on with your computer or your software? Love to hear from you. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today with Beth Wendt, Senior IT Specialist at Madison UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. Give a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Someone else wondered if you had recommendations on how to keep track of passwords effectively.
Yeah, I do. I use a tool called LastPass, which is it's a product that you can purchase for a yearly subscription fee. where you have a single master password that unlocks basically a safe where you keep all of your other passwords. They use what's called multi-factor authentication for access to that password vault. And I think we've talked in previous shows a little bit, Larry, about multi-factor authentication, which is where you would maybe enter a username and password and then get a prompt on your cell phone to accept the access to that service so that you could retrieve a password if you need to. And then it also remembers passwords on your devices so that it'll fill them in for you based on you logging into the main service with your main password. So I would highly recommend something like LastPass, or there are a couple of other vendors that have similar. I think PasswordSafe is another one that I've seen, but there's multiple products out there.
What is that? What's the cost of that, roughly?
You know, for a single user license, I would imagine less than like $30 for a year subscription. It's not an expensive product and worthwhile to keep things safe.
Yeah, $30 for a little peace of mind. That's not bad.
No.
Oh boy, Ray, in Tofty, Minnesota. Your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hey there.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I can't hear you. Okay, so I have a question about Wi-Fi password security.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the safety of Wi-Fi?
Yep.
Okay.
A problem where someone is hacking into my internet and they're playing this thing called the Brown Note.
Oh. So we got to have somebody hacked into his system. Ray's having a little problem because he's been hacked into, Beth.
It sounds to me like Ray's playing a prank.
Oh, you think so?
I do.
All right, Ray, you prankster. We'll let you go and we'll talk to Beth. What about Wi-Fi safety? Anyway, that's not a bad question.
No, that actually is a good question. And another thing that folks can do to protect their information is to be very wary of public Wi-Fi. So if you're out at a coffee shop and they have a public wide open Wi-Fi for everybody to use, I would be really careful about what I was accessing while I'm on that public Wi-Fi network, or what device I was using to access it with. To make sure the device I was using was up to date on its security software, again, with the operating system up to date and things like that. But public Wi-Fi is really going to be your most likely spot to run into trouble with somebody hacking into your system.
Not the time to be looking at your bank balances.
No, definitely not.
Let's go to Betsy in River Falls. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, I have sort of a similar question. I have never owned a computer. I've never owned a smartphone, but I was thinking about buying myself a smartphone. And I'm 77 years old, so I'm not really up with a whole bunch of stuff. And how much would I have to be concerned about security and having a smartphone? I understand that I'm not going to use Wi-Fi in any place other than my house, thanks to you. But is there anything else I should worry about, or should I just stick with my little old crack phone?
Okay. What do you think, Beth?
You know, nowadays, the smartphones are, they've made them so easy to use that it's probably a good way for folks to kind of enter into the computer world. You know, especially Apple, the iPhones are, they're just so intuitive and very simple to use. You don't really need to know much about how computers work. And there, you can do most anything you would do with a regular computer on a smartphone these days. So, you know, there's almost no need to have one on your desk anymore. But, you know, for security concerns, you know, making sure the automatic updates are set up on your phone so that it's updating itself every time a new security version is released. That's always a good way to make sure your phone's going to be safe. And then the password software that I was talking about, LastPass, is something that you can also use on your mobile device to keep your passwords safe on there. The nice thing about most of the new phones is they come with, biometric scanners that are required for getting access into the phone. So, a thumbprint reader or a retina scan. So it's become much more difficult for people to actually hack into the devices.
So it's sounds like a pretty good way for you to start, Betsy. Thank you so much for calling. Ralph in Stevens Point, your turn now. Hi, Ralph.
Yeah, I was just curious if you could discuss VPNs a little bit and whether that would be a good idea.
All right, VPNs, and I'm sure some people are wondering what the heck's a VPN.
Yeah, VPN. So that's the acronym stands for a virtual private network, and that's really exactly what it is. It's creating what we would call a tunnel through the internet, basically a secure channel from your machine to the service or system that you are communicating with. That's encrypted with a much higher level of encryption than a standard internet connection would be. So you're kind of creating this like a safe passage through the internet on a virtual private network. It does slow things down sometimes. So, if you're trying to stream video or, do things that require a whole lot of internet speed, using a VPN could be a drawback. I use a VPN most of the time when I work from home. So in COVID days, I'm on a VPN pretty much constantly. But most often it's used for remote workers to be able to get into secure systems within their organization. And now I think more folks in private homes are starting to adopt the use of them as well.
So anybody could set one up. How do you do that?
There are various software programs that you can download that have VPN capabilities, but I would recommend looking into whether or not the security software that you already have installed on your computer, if it's one of the Symantec products, which are very popular, or the McAfee products, which are really popular. Often those will have a VPN portion to them already built in that you can use.
Gotcha. Barbara in Delafield, your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I am not tech savvy at all, and I keep hearing people talk about how voting machines can be hacked, but a paper ballot can't. Well, I live in Delafield, and we get a paper ballot when we vote, but then we put the paper ballot into a machine. Now, what does that fall under? Is that safe or not for the voter?
So those scanners that you feed the paper ballots into aren't actually connected to the internet. Those are machines that are not, they don't talk to each other. They don't talk to other computers. What it is more of a counting machine. So you fill out the paper ballot like you would maybe the old style of exams when I was a kid. Filling in the bubbles, and then the machine reads those bubbles and makes a count of the vote tally. And then the total count that's on that machine is added with the rest of the machines in more of a central system. So that vote counting machine isn't really what is worrisome about electronic voting processes. It's more the virtual voting where you actually push a button on a machine to cast your ballot.
Yeah, in Madison, we have similar to what Barbara in Delafield has, and you feel a lot more, you feel like your vote is really counting, for sure. There's not much that could go wrong with that.
Barbara, I really do like having that paper ballot in my hand. I don't know what it is, but it just makes me feel better about what I'm doing.
Yeah, me too. Barbara, thank you. Jackie in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about, I'm old and I need to get a computer, and I do have a smartphone, so I'm not totally ignorant, but perhaps a TV and a new smartphone that would all kind of connect. I do some classes at UW, and I understand they're going to be online, so So, and I'm just curious to know if you have a recommendation for people that walk me through that process, maybe go with me or suggest things to me so that everything can be synced up together.
That's a great question.
I think a lot of folks are looking for, in the tech world, we call this a digital ecosystem, which is a group of devices that all work together on a very similar platform so that you can kind of seamlessly move between them without having to do a lot of extra work to make that happen. And a couple of examples of that are pretty far ahead of the pack. Apple is a really strong player in the world of creating a digital ecosystem with their iPhone line, their laptop line of MacBooks and AirBooks that are very simple to use. And then they also have Apple TV, which is you can buy TVs with it built in, or you can buy a separate little box that plugs into your existing TV that'll convert it. And having those three devices working together really creates this digital, like I said, a digital environment for you to work in where everything looks very similar and you find things in the same places and your data moves between those devices fairly seamlessly. Another vendor that's really good in that market now is Samsung as well, with their Samsung line of iPhones and their smart TVs. I know they're making some fantastic smart TVs that can synchronize right up to your phone and into your laptop as well. So those are two examples.
And how would Jackie, what's the best way for her to look into all this?
So if it were me, I would kind of shop piecemeal and piece them together, pricing-wise. But I know enough to be able to kind of go out and comparison shop and be able to figure it out on my own. But for folks who aren't as native to the digital world as I am, you probably won't get the best price, but you'll get the best service on something like that, going with like a Best Buy, going in and talking to someone in the store, having them walk you through the different options for that digital environment. And then they can give you some instruction on how to set all of it up, or they can even send their Geek Squad service out to your house to set it up for you.
Yeah, it's nice to have somebody come and set it all up for you. That's very good. Jackie, you're not taking my radio class this fall, are you?
I don't think so, but I might. Who knows? I don't know what we're going to be allowed to do. It's just an amazing experience to be able to do that, and I don't want to miss out.
Well, good for you. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Susan in Menasha up next. Hi, Susan.
Yes, I was just wondering if you could tell me, starting yesterday, I started getting a note on my computer when I try to access my email, a note saying they couldn't find a secure connection. I have Windows 10 on there. It's only about a month old. I was still getting my email on my phone. But what I was wondering is if this has something to do with Windows 10, or if it might have to do with I do have AVG security and I do have a VPN. Could it have something to do with that?
What do you think, Beth?
What application are you using to check your email?
I'm using Google Chrome. Is that what you mean? Or
you go through an internet browser to pull up your
Correct.
Email, or do you use something like Outlook? Okay, so you're using a web browser to do it, Google Chrome.
Correct.
It sounds to me then you're not making a secure internet connection in Chrome. It may be that Chrome needs an update. So I would check in the settings of Chrome. If you go to the little gear wheel thing in the right upper right-hand corner, that'll take you to the settings of Chrome. And you can go in and check for updates to see if it won't make a secure connection because of that. And you said you're still getting the emails on your phone?
Yes, and actually I did do some troubleshooting yesterday and this morning too, and when I do unplug my router and the computer at the same time, leave it off for about 5 minutes, plug it back in, I'm more apt to be able to access it. Okay, it's not that I can't access it at all. It's just happening periodically.
Sounds like it's chugging along trying to find a connection entirely. Are you able to access other websites while that's happening?
Yes.
Okay. So the internet itself is working, but it's not getting to your email site.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah,
and I have AT&T, which also is Yahoo. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, I would see if it makes a difference shutting off your VPN.
Okay.
And also I would see if it makes a difference shutting off your security suite just for a short period of time to see if you're able to access it with that shut off, and then you'll be able to kind of eliminate a few things from what potentially is the problem.
Yeah, the first thing I thought of was security.
Yeah, usually it's a security suite or a VPN or potentially a security update that needs to be run.
Okay. There you go. Thank you so much, Susan, for calling. Appreciate your call. Barbara in Glenwood, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. My question is this. For years in our home, we've had a desktop and a laptop, and of course, we pay for those security devices you mentioned to protect us from hackers and so forth. Our iPhone and my iPad are newer acquisitions, and I've gone along since we acquired those just assuming that I have the same kind of protection on those two devices at times when, say, I use Amazon from the newer devices or read my emails and respond. Do I have that same protection on the iPad and the iPhone?
Yeah, that's not something that you would have out of the box. Generally, if you have a security suite on your laptop or your computer at home, those will often come with, and it really depends on which one you're using, but they'll often come with a license for multiple devices and a version of their security suite for your mobile devices that you need to download to that device and enable. So if you're using something like Symantec, which is the one that I'm most familiar with, you buy a license for it from the company, and it comes with the ability to install on up to 5 devices. So I can install the version on my laptop, and then I can go to my iPhone, and I can download the version of Symantec on my iPhone, and I can do the same on my iPad. So I have the same security software on all of my devices. But there are going to be specific versions of that software for each device that you have, and you'll have to download it from that device.
All right. Barbara, does that help?
Yeah. Do I look at the settings on those other devices to know if I already have it?
Unless you put them on there, they're not there.
Yeah. Yep. There you go, Barbara. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Beth Wendt, our guest today, she's senior IT specialist with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Beth Wendt, from the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, talking a lot about security with your computer, but taking certainly other questions as well. And looking forward to your question at 800-642-1234 or via email at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Ken in Butternut, Wisconsin next. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, folks. I am calling to pass along a tip on doing purchasing on the Internet. I do all of my purchases via a debit card. I don't have charge cards, so in order to protect my checking accounts with those debit cards, I have actually opened 2 checking accounts with my bank. One I use specifically for the Internet purchases, which I keep a zero balance in. And when I make a purchase and I use that debit card, I transfer the funds into that account specifically for that purchase so that I never have any more money in that account than a specific purchase for a specific time. And that way, you know, if the account gets hacked, there's nothing in it. And, you know, no one has access to my main account.
That sounds like it could work. Beth, what do you think?
I think that's, you know, really a good way to handle it if you don't want to own a credit card rather than just a debit card. I would definitely recommend that folks who do have a credit card use the credit card rather than a debit card for shopping online because of the way that fraudulent purchases are handled between the two is very different. On a debit card, you can be liable for fraudulent purchases, and it also can take much longer for you to actually get the money put back into your account once it's deemed that the purchase was a fraud. Whereas with a credit card, generally there is no penalty against the consumer for a fraudulent purchase on their card. So if you don't have a credit card, Ken, I think that's a great way to really manage your account so that you're not going to lose any money. But if you did have a credit card, I would very much recommend using that over a debit account.
Yeah, me too. I use my credit card a lot more than my debit card for sure. And I've had situations where the credit card company's been very quick. In fact, I got a call from them saying, hey, did you buy a necklace and want it shipped to Arizona? And I said, no. And they said, okay. We'll take care of that for you. So I think that's good advice. John in Mount, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, thank you. We live in a quite a rural area, and we only have one internet service provider as a choice out here, and their speed is not very good. My question is, I occasionally hear about hotspots. People connecting to the internet via a hotspot, and could your guest explain what a hotspot is, and would this be an alternative for someone like me who has slow internet service?
All right. Good question, too. Beth?
Yeah, I know a lot of folks, especially in Wisconsin, run into this problem because there are so many isolated or rural areas in the state where you're far enough away from a populated region where you just can't get decent standard internet service. Hotspot. Now, I have one question for you, actually, before I answer. Is your cell phone service decent where you live?
Yes, we have Verizon cell phone service, and that's quite good.
Okay, so a hotspot, what that does is it takes the cellular signal and allows you to use that cellular signal as your internet connection for whatever device you connect to that hotspot. It's never going to be as fast as, internet that you would get in the city, you know, near to a provider where you would get, you know, cable internet or broadband. But in most regions, actually, you're going to get 4G LTE speeds, which is going to be at least enough to stream video successfully. Better than most of the rural broad or standard internet connections that are out there. I would recommend if you have Verizon for your cell phone service and you get a good, strong cell phone signal where you live, then you go with Verizon to purchase your hotspot. I also know as far as many of the rural areas in Wisconsin, U.S. Cellular is also a very good carrier for coverage in more remote locations. So if you want to purchase a hotspot, I would go with the cell phone provider that gets the best coverage in your area.
Ah, very good advice. John, thank you so much. Appreciate it. I'm sure a lot of people will benefit from that question and the advice given. Logan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Logan.
Hi. Yeah, I play video games online, people will call me and say that they get my IP address, and I want to know if they actually can do something with that, because they say they're gonna like order pizzas to my house. I'm just not sure about it.
Yeah, they can't do anything with your IP address. IP address, what that is internet protocol address, and it's a way for all of the devices that speak to each other out on the internet to identify your particular internet connection in that moment. But most likely your IP address changes every time you reboot your machine or your router. Most people don't have the same one all the time. Called a dynamic IP address. So your internet service provider assigns you one, and those change pretty frequently. They don't correspond to your actual physical address unless the hacker were to hack into your internet service provider and find logs that matched up your username with your IP address, and then they hacked into their other system to find out what your username corresponded to as you as a human being. So it would take a lot of hops for them to get there. So somebody saying they know your IP address is really them just trying to get a rise out of you, I think.
There you go, Logan. Thank you. Connie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Connie.
Hi, two things. The first is I am a recent convert to smartphone. I did it just before the COVID lockdown. And I want to warn the people with flip phones that you will probably have to transfer all your phone numbers into your contact list manually. There was not a single way, not a comma separated file or a Verizon assisted transfer or an Apple assisted transfer that could possibly work. I was a long holdout and the chasm was very wide. But I have to say, I'm an absolute convert. The quality of the alerts that I get, my scheduling, everything in one place, it's just a remarkable improvement in the quality of my life. And I know there are privacy issues, and I was hoping to hold out, but I think I did pretty well. Here's my question. Could you define firmware, and could you discuss firmware updates for wireless routers for home networks? I attempted to update the firmware of my 2-year-old wireless router, and I could not get into their it's a Netgear wireless router, and I couldn't get into their. They gave me instructions, but they ignored my attempt to log in and do what needed to be done, even through using their app.
Hmm.
All right. So firmware is really just some permanent software that's built into some of the hardware of the machine that basically allows the different components of the machine to be able to communicate with each other. As companies recognize bugs in what they've previously built, they create patches or updates for that firmware that fix things that they previously didn't identify. So they will release what's called firmware updates for you to download. And similar to, if you've ever heard of drivers, those are kind of a similar type of software that, you know, once in a while requires some updating to fix some of the older bugs or quirks in the program. With a router, often when things start to go kind of slow with your internet connection, oftentimes the vendor of that router will advise folks to update their firmware in order to speed things up. So that's one of the first things they'll tell you to do, update any software, update any operating systems, and update firmware. But it's not always as easy as it sounds. So with any kind of router or any of those devices that basically give you connectivity to the internet, there is always an administrative, basically an administrative address that allows you to reach the software that's on that router to make changes to the settings. That's probably what you were trying to log into. But you need to know what the username and password for that device would be in order to log in to do that firmware update. Oftentimes, if you haven't set a username and password on it, the username will be admin and the password will be blank. That's how many of those machines come by default. So if you haven't proactively set a username and password on it, you can try that. And I found that about 75% of the time it works on routers.
So just type in admin,
admin. Yep, admin, and then no password.
All right. Connie, does that help out?
I think I did all of that when I set the router up, and I think I wrote it all down in the little booklet that lives underneath the wireless router because, you know, most of us won't be thinking about that for a really long time. So,
right.
I'll all see right. what I can do about accessing that information. Okay, thank yeah. you very much for the information.
You're welcome. Bye.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much for calling in. Well, we're talking with Beth Wendt today. She's had over 20 years, or about 20 years, I guess, in IT, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's DOIT, Division of Information Technology. We'll take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. Then we'll be back with Beth. She'll be with us right to 12:30. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at your computer and software with Beth Wendt. Joining us today, she's a senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, 20 years of lab experience. So great to have her back, talking about ransomware attacks and that sort of thing, but taking other computer questions as well. If you have a problem, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. John in Fitchburg has a question for you, Beth, so let's go to John in Fitchburg. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I have a question for your guest. My son has inherited an Apple Mac from his mother. And he wants to upgrade the operating system because it's pretty old and he can't even use a lot of apps and so forth on it. And the problem is she doesn't remember what password she had on there, if any. And is there some way that could get updated, the operating system, without having the password?
Yeah, actually, there's a process with Apple that you can use to do what we call a hard reset. So if you've got a pen and paper, I can give you the steps real quick that you're going to walk through just to get to a place where you can reset the password so that you can then log into it like you normally would. So
unfortunately, I don't have a pen and paper right now.
All right. Well, I can go through it quickly. Really the key, the most important thing to remember is when you, and if you want to, get step-by-step instructions on how to do this when you're in a place when you're going to go to do it, you can look up on Google Macintosh hard reset. But the quick steps to do this would be when the Mac is turned off completely, you're going to press down the Command and the R key at the same time and hold those down while you turn it on. And you're going to keep holding those down until you see a little progress bar pop up on the screen. That'll tell you that the Mac is going to boot up in what's called recovery mode. And once it comes back up to life and the screen is ready to view, you're in recovery mode. There is an option called utilities. And then there's something called a terminal. And then in that terminal window, you type in just a simple command that is reset password, all one word. And if you don't have pen and paper to write this stuff down, the next time you're in front of another computer, if you want to Google Mac recovery mode or Mac hard reset, it'll give you those step-by-step instructions on how to do it.
Yep. And remember, we archive these shows as well.
Right.
So you can go to wpr.org/ Larry, and you could hear the recording of this broadcast, and it'd be pretty easy to find this spot. We're at about 10 minutes after, about 9 minutes after 12. You could find it. Search by topic and date at our WPR.org/Larry. So that's another way. Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Well, Dan in Appleton up next. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thank you.
What can we do for you?
I'm curious about Apple phones. They always say that they're so secure, but I looked up online one time that if somebody can use that hacking software to get into your Apple ID, they essentially can control your phone remotely and install any software they want on it.
What do you think, Beth?
They won't be able to control your phone remotely, but what they would be able to do is gain access to any data that you're synchronizing from your phone to your iCloud account. That Apple ID gives you access to anything in Apple's iCloud. And so if you're synchronizing your contacts and your emails to back it up, and you're synchronizing your calendar, things like that, if somebody gets a hold of your Apple ID and password, then they would be able to get access to all of that information. But they can't actually remotely control your phone from that tool. The worst they could do is possibly remotely reset your phone so that it blanks all the data out.
But then they're not gaining anything out of it either, so why
right.
would they?
Yeah, so it's not as much of a concern. It's really just whatever data you're backing up to their cloud that then could be compromised if someone got a hold of that credential.
All right. Thank you, Dan, for calling. Appreciate it. Ron in La Crosse, it's your turn now. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I read in a library book once, if you really don't want any hackers to infest your computer, they had a sort of a retro suggestion that you should go with dial-up modem, you know, if you're worried about, you know, a transaction online that's going to involve, you know, financial or anything, because it's harder for them to get into a modem if it's not on all the time. With dial-up, it's not on all the time.
All right, Beth, what would be the upside and downside of that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that the upside being that it's not a permanent connection like your DSL or your other broadband internet connection would be. Dial-up is actually probably the least secure form of internet communication because of the way it travels. So those signals travel over old telephone lines, analog telephone lines, or what we call POTS lines, plain old telephone system is that acronym. those old telephone lines are the easiest wires to hack. They can be tapped very, very simply. Somebody can place a device in between where you're transmitting from and where you're transmitting to, anywhere on that line, and capture your signal and decrypt it very, very easily. So I wouldn't recommend dial-up as a security measure, other than the fact that you have to intentionally dial in to do what you want to do on the internet and then close the connection when you're finished. So it's not going to just sit on all the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Ron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Carol emailed with some questions about Google Photo and its storage space. She says prior to yesterday, she had very little storage space left, and she had to delete some old photos to make room for a few more. She didn't want to purchase more space. Then her son asked her to share about 50 photos with a recent vacation on Google Photo. So she clicked and shared. Now she says there's 99% storage space left, or just less than 1% she had before. She doesn't know what happened and why she suddenly has all this storage space. Any ideas?
Well, I guess if the photos are, I guess it really depends on whether she actually shared them or moved them. It was that she chose to move those files to someone else's Google Photo account, instead of actually just sharing them with somebody, it would clean those out of her account and move them into somebody else's. And that's why she would see the, you know, the drastic drop in the amount of storage space she was using. So it really kind of depends on what action she chose to take on those photos.
Ed from Gurnee, Illinois, emailed with a few questions. How is it that hackers can try many passwords to get onto a website when many secure sites will lock the account after a few attempts? Are hackers somehow unable to bypass or somehow able to bypass the normal sign in screen?
Yeah, some of those password tracking tools that I was talking about earlier have the ability to set delays in their attempts to kind of outsmart those systems that lock your password for periods of time. But they also have ways to, you know, anytime you pass a username and password from your machine to another machine, there's a handshake made between those two machines to say, I am who I say I am, you are who you say you are, and we can talk to each other. And if you're sending a password through, oftentimes those crackers can detect one side of the handshake, meaning the correct password was not submitted, but then they can interrupt the signal that comes back to lock the actual account.
Oh.
So they don't actually trigger the mechanism then that would tell the receiving system that there's something nefarious happening. They're pretty smart.
Yeah, they are. Ed also wondered, and we have mentioned this, but it's the importance of secondary authorization, like getting a text or email with a code you have to enter when signing in, which is comforting to have that.
Yeah, that multi-factor authentication is really a great way to have peace of mind with your devices and your accounts. It's just, you know, seeing that handshake between your device and that machine happen in real time and prompting you for, are you sure that you are who you say you are on another device? Just that added level of security, you're creating layers. So it's much more difficult for people to get at your data.
Yeah. B in Madison, your turn now. Hi, B.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have an Samsung 7 model. And from what I understand about Android phones, they don't patch, they don't essentially repair. And so the iPhone is more secure for that reason. My phone still works fine, but from a hack point of view, would it be more susceptible?
Yeah, and that, you know, that happens with Apple products as well. I don't think they sunset as quickly as Samsung does. So basically what happens is once you get two or three generations of hardware behind, the vendor that you purchase that hardware from will often stop supporting that older, what we call legacy hardware. They'll stop producing those security updates for it at a certain point in time. Usually that's in the 2 to 3 generations range. So if a Samsung Galaxy 10 is the latest version that you can buy in the store, then a 7 is probably right at that precipice of no longer having updates created for it. And from what I'm seeing, the last update released for that version was in June.
Okay.
So it may be that to keep a most, you know, that's kind of how the companies get you, is they stop supporting the old stuff. So in order to stay secure, you're going to have to buy the new stuff.
Hmm. There you go, baby. Appreciate the call. Well, Kevin in Dodge County, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Hey, thank you guys so much. And Ms. Expert, I'm sorry, I'm not good with names. I forgot your name.
Beth.
But here's Beth. Okay. Beth. Okay, here's the situation. I'm going to make it as quick as concise as I can. My old phone would light up randomly, light up and at weird times at night. But I don't always sleep that well, so at times where people would think you wouldn't even notice the phone, and I would notice, like, my contacts slowly scrolling through, and then I'd find some of my private texts out on the internet from an old girlfriend site. And anyway, so I was wondering if my phone was damaged or whatever. It would light on, light off. It would do all this stuff, and it would remotely call people. a doctor friend of mine, and I asked her, I said, hey, did you get the phone call on Saturday morning? Because my phone just called somebody, and when I looked and seen, well, who did you call? It said it called you. And she goes, no, I never got that call. I go, man, I don't know if I'm going to be swatted or what. But anyway, I went into a little research, and I found a section in the phone. It's called, or this is what I have. I just pulled it out of my file, so I might be forgetting some parts. But I wrote this stuff down under a section called MIN. And then there's, I don't want to put too much out there, okay? But there is a name under that. First, it was my own phone number, so I know I have remote access to the phone, obviously. It's my number. But then this other one come up that, and the name, I won't say the whole name, but it was, and it corresponds to an ex-girlfriend's friend who is very tech-savvy, and so is she. And then there was a phone number with it, too. And that's something that's in an ESN number under that. I wrote it all down, and one night I actually called that phone number. I did it under that private setting just to see if, and somebody answered right away, so it's a real phone number, and it wasn't a business, and I didn't recognize it was her voice or her friend's voice, and I didn't engage in any conversation. But I also have with this section of somebody that I never gave permission to and that has administrative access, I don't know how they got it, with the ESN number also.
Wow. And
is that a federal crime? For somebody to do that to your phone?
Well, it's a crime for anybody to hack into any of your accounts or devices. It is a crime, absolutely.
So how does he deal with this? How does Kevin deal with this?
In all honesty, it sounds like, without looking at it, I'm suspicious of somebody potentially putting some remote surveillance software on your phone or some sort of a remote access tool. I would get rid of the phone. Honestly, it's really the only way to ensure 100% that you've gotten rid of any traces of what somebody might be trying to do. You can also take it to the vendor, so whoever you bought the phone from, whichever of the cell phone providers, and they can run some diagnostics on it for you. They may charge you for that, but it would probably be worthwhile to find out if there actually is something happening on there that you need to report to law enforcement.
Yeah, I think I'd take it in and get that information for sure. Kevin, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Janice in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Janice.
Hi. If what has been hacked, and this is a crazy question, I suppose, but how do you avoid having that happen to you again? And also, how do you avoid getting more emails than you want?
No.
Ah, yes, the full inbox. I can empathize. So as far as, preventing a hack from happening again, some of the tips I gave earlier in the show are really going to go a long way towards protecting your system. And the top one that I can't stress enough is not to reuse your password. So if you have a password, specific to your laptop, don't use that for your bank account password or your MyChart password or your Netflix password or anything like that. Use different passwords for all of the various tools that you use online. That's going to be the best thing you can do to protect your systems. And I mentioned earlier a couple of tools that help with that, something like a LastPass or a Password Safe. A secure way to store all of your passwords and transmit those in an encrypted way will protect you from getting hacked. Avoiding using public Wi-Fi when you're on your devices. Ensuring that when you're purchasing things online, that you're doing so from trusted vendors who have been reviewed by reputable online sites. And also, another thing I don't think I mentioned, but beware of prices that seem too low when you're buying from any vendor online. It's generally a good indicator that it's a potential scam site. So if seems too good to be true, stay away from it.
Yeah, those are all really good tips. And actually, it's kind of a nice way to summarize part of the show today, Beth. A listener emailed to say, She recently unsubscribed to eBay's email list, and they did stop coming after a few days, but then all of their primary incoming Gmails disappeared as well. Do you have a simple means to restore them or a website for someone who is not web savvy?
You know, I'm thinking maybe that they didn't disappear, but it may be that the caller, the listener, is confused by how Gmail is organizing the view of their mail. Oftentimes it can look like Gmail items have disappeared because they're getting sorted into specific folders. And there are tabs at the top of your Gmail screen that show you the different categories that your email has been sorted into. So it's possible that a box got checked inadvertently when unsubscribing to something or making some changes in the email system that's causing things to flow into a different folder than you're used to seeing them. So I would check each of those tabs or any of the subfolders underneath the inbox to make sure they didn't just move to a different location.
Yeah. Remember that caller early on about who asked about the voting polls in New Berlin, Wisconsin? And we had a listener called in to say they have the machine where you feed the paper ballot into it for a count. But she also wanted listeners to know that in addition to the digit count, they are also physically counting by hard ballots afterwards, and they do it more than once.
Well, that gives me some peace of mind, is knowing that somebody is physically counting paper ballots really helps give me some confidence. I hope that's happening statewide.
Yeah, you hope it probably takes a little bit longer, but you know what? It's probably a very good thing. Well, in the last minute here or so, any last advice for our listeners?
I think just be diligent. Make sure that you keep things up to date on your devices. When you get prompted for a security update, run it. Back up your data and don't reuse your password.
All right. On that note, Beth, we will close. I want to thank you so much for being with us. And let's see, you're going to be back again on Monday, September 14th. Oh, no, actually, Jesse LeGrew will be back on Monday, September 14th, I believe.
I'm October.
You're in October, but you did a great job today, and thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry. It was really great to talk to you again.
Beth Wendt worked in IT for nearly 20 years, senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She loves to find creative solutions to problems, and I thought she did a really nice job on it. Tomorrow on the show, it's our health focus day, so first we'll talk about mental health with Shyla Mergain. Then at 11:45, we talk about psoriasis. What is it? What triggers it? And how to treat it? And certainly take a look at our blog. If you'd like to hear more about our guests or show topics, check out our blog. In fact, there's a new post up there today all about, there is a post about me hosting the show during the pandemic. So just go to WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. In the meantime, I thank you all for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store for us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.